Hi, I'm Charlie McGettigan, and you're listening to the Breffni Early Show.
Breffni, you come all the way from Ireland for this adventure.
Isn't Breffni Early a real tonic, full of positivity?
It's an amazing story, Breffni, what a wonderful, happy ending.
All of those things on your bucket list wouldn't necessarily have led you to do the World Cycle Race.
27 countries, 490 days. 18,000 miles on a bike.
You've decided that's it. You're going to keep giving yourself challenges.
Welcome to the Breffni Early Show, where each week we talk to somebody who is interesting, inspirational, and motivational. And this week I have a guest who fits all of those descriptions, in my opinion. Back in 1994, became internationally known after winning the Eurovision Song Contest with Paul Harrington with the iconic song Rock and Roll Kids. Charlie McGettigan, welcome to the programme.
It's nice to be here. I like the way you have three. Now they always have three sort of things. What were those? Motivational, inspirational, and...
Interesting.
Interesting. But of course there are about 503 about me, really.
Oh?
Yeah, I have a lot more to me than those three things.
Would you care to divulge?
I don't want to start. We'd be here all day.
Now, obviously, I'm a Leitrim man.
Yes.
You live in County Leitrim. Mm-hmm. Do you see yourself as a Donegal man living in Leitrim, or are you kind of adopted now at this stage?
I'm not one for... I hate labels, you know, for example. And I got into an awful lot of trouble. For example, you talked about Eurovision there. The second reprise of the... when we'd won the song, you know, I decided, you know, we were sitting under the piano to do the reprise of the song. And I said, this is for Drumshambo. And the amount of people in Donegal that took offence at that. You're not from Drumshambo, you're from Donegal. Yet I had been living there 30-odd years at that stage. I'm now 42 years living in Leitrim. Came to live in Leitrim thinking I was going to be here for about 6 months to work with the ESB way back in 1973. And now I'm in my 42nd year here. So I don't like to label, you know, I'm just me. And I'm living, and I'm. If you ask me where I'm from, I've come from Drumshambo today, so I'm from Drumshambo.
When let's rewind a little bit before 1973. What was Charlie McGettigan like growing up as a kid in Ballyshannon?
It was, you know, people talk about the 50s. It was a very great time. People always think of the 50s in black and white, because when you think of a lot of movies were still coming out in black and white at that time. There was no television. It was radio all the way. And, you know, I was born in Dublin in Hollis Street Hospital. My mother was from a place called Effra Road in Rathmines. My father met her at a dance in Bundoran, of all places. She was down on her holidays in Bundoran in the Imperial Hotel. They met and they married in 1948, and I came along in 1950. And I suppose the first 5 or 6 months would have been living in Dublin. And then my dad went back to work in Ballyshannon in his father's shop. His father had a shop called McGettigan and McGowan's. Himself and a fellow called Phil McGowan, the two men owned it. Then Phil left the business and it became McGettigan and Son. So, you know, that's how I ended up, went to school. I always think of my first day in school, you know, people ask me, what was the first song you ever remember hearing or ever remember learning to sing? And it was something like, the bells of the Angelus calling to me in sweet tones announcing the sacred Ave, 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 Ave Maria, Ave, Ave, Ave Maria. And that would have been, you know, I remember the first day in school and I looked up and I saw this really big black, what I thought was an animal, you know, with a white thing across and these big piercing eyes. And it was Sister Lazarian, who was the principal of the local school. And I was scared. I thought, you know, so as soon as the 11 o'clock break came, I said, now I've had enough of this, thank you. But I went home to a house we'd been previously living in. So the whole town was in a panic. Where had he gone? You know, where did he disappear to? I was so confused and frightened that I went to a house that we had left a year previously. And here I was sitting up eating jam sandwiches in Kerrigan's house in Clun Baron, and the whole town was in a panic. Where did he disappear to?
So you ran away at the age of
four? I ran away at the age of four. And but I suppose that's where it started. And in a way, Breffni, music was very much part of our lives in the 50s, because you were always taught, no matter what class you were in school, there was a music teacher, and you learned your tonic solfège, your do re mi's, and all that can carry on. And learned, you know, you were singing, you know, there was always a day, a part of the day was devoted to singing in school. And the convent school, I stayed there until I made my first communion, and there was always singing, like the Bells of the Angelus and songs like that. And then you went to we went to the Brothers' Den. I remember we marched across from the convent, which was about a mile walk, to this new place, which is the Brothers, the De La Salle Brothers in Ballyshannon, up on the hill there, in a place called The Rock. Incidentally, The Rock Hospital is right beside the school. It's where Rory Gallagher was born. And it's a very unusual to think that a rock musician would be born in a place called The Rock Hospital. It was just the name of the place. But and that was a different experience. Suddenly you were into these big, burly men in black and white, you know, brothers, and they wore cassocks, and you know, they were the full regalia. And I suppose education was largely violent. You know, it was a violent time. You know, I remember getting, you know, slapped a lot and kicked around a lot and pushed around and stuff like that. And that wasn't the pupils, that was the teachers. And but you sort of learned to live with it, but it was largely fear. You know, I remember a lot of days going to school in primary school, right up until sixth class, and right up, I suppose, up until about intercert, being afraid going to school. You know, being afraid, because if you were something you hadn't done in your homework, or there was somebody who were late or whatever it was, you generally speaking got six of the best, you know, which was, I remember one particular brother, and I was in third class, and his favourite trick was, he'd say to you, you haven't your homework done, okay, here's sixpence. And then you think, oh, sixpence, I haven't homework done. No, I want you to go up to Stevens's shop, and if you go in there, they sell canes in there. You go in and give Mr. Stevens a sixpence, and he'll give you a cane and bring it back, and this is your instrument of getting beaten with.
So you had to go through, you actually had to go and
buy your instrument of torture, you know.
Wow.
And you know, so it just,
you had to whole walk to the school,
yeah,
to the shop.
You had to walk to the shop back, the whole way back, knowing that when you got back, you were going to get the...
On one level, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
And on another level, that's absolutely inhumane.
Terrible. I mean, you wouldn't even dream of it happening now. Funny, you're the first person that this has ever... I've never actually come out with this before. I've never talked about, you know, that... Because it just occurred to me how violent it was. And how a lot of the time, you were afraid in school. You were afraid because... I remember I do a program called Glortira now for TG4, and I have to speak in Irish. And every time I speak in Irish, I'm almost ducking because I'm afraid if I get my Mo Canaleb mixed up with my Amtsar Ochnock or whatever it is, that then I'm going to get a wallop. Because that's how you were taught. You were taught by threat, you know, a lot of the time.
It's funny, my dad would be slightly older than yourself, and he has almost a resentment of Irish because he did his entire schooling through Irish.
A lot of people did, yeah.
And he went to university to study engineering and didn't know what the basic terms were because he'd never learnt them. He'd done it through Irish. So he actually had to go and buy a secondary school engineering book to learn the vocabulary that was being used in university.
But despite all the violence and all that and all the fear, I love Irish because, you know, I always loved it at school. I loved, you know, the language, and we went to the Gaeltacht as kids, you know, when we were teenagers, and you know, I had a great love for Irish, although having left school, the opportunities to speak it again never arose until this TG4 program came up. And it's remarkable, the brain will remember all that, the stuff that you did 40, 50 years ago.
It does come back very quickly.
It does.
So obviously, we didn't introduce the other member of the Charlie McGettigan troupe that's here today, is your guitar.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
Well, guitars, you know, I'm, 65 years of age now, and I'm still like a child with toys, with guitars. If I go to a big city, you know, whether it be in Europe, America, or here, the first place I wonder about, is there a guitar shop? Is there a music shop? And my first guitar, the first time I ever saw a guitar was in a shop window in Ballyshannon. And it was, I remember it distinctly, it was a green guitar with a white palm tree on the front of it. And I said, that is something, you know. And I imagined, and I said, I'm going to try and get Dad to buy me that for Christmas and stuff. The next thing, it disappeared. And a fellow called Michael Doherty bought the guitar. And it would only have been about maybe £10 at the time, which was a fortune in those days. But I remember calling to his house and I said, do you mind if I touch your guitar? And I remember being slightly disappointed that you had to do things that just doesn't play by itself, you know. And it was coming up to we used to have this thing called the County Council Scholarship. If you did this exam, remember, you had to pay for second level education in those days. So if you got paid, you got €39 a year, or pounds a year, towards your education. And a friend of mine, Arthur Green, got the £39 that particular year. And I persuaded him to buy a guitar with some of it. And he bought this guitar. I knew he had a note in his head, you know, but I persuaded him. Very persuasive kind of fella. And I said, do you mind if I borrow it, Arthur? You know, after a few months, he wasn't learning anything. So I convinced...
He commandeered it, basically.
Yeah, it was a dreadful thing. It was £3 it was. And it was a dreadful guitar. But I learned to play three chords on it. And I learned to sing a song. And my father and mother were convinced, oh, he's going to be the next Semprini, you know, get him out there. And they bought me a guitar for Christmas that year. And that would have been 1963.
But that's actually quite a good lesson in terms of go as cheaply as you can and see if you like it. And then convince others maybe that you actually got a bit of a talent for it.
Not quite. People come to me, you know, usually on Stevens's Day, they'll arrive at the door, I bought Johnny a guitar for Christmas, would you tune it up for him? And I get these things, and with all the best will in the world, the child is never going to learn anything on these because they're so bad. At least if you're going to spend a small amount of money, spend it on the best guitar you can find for the price. Because at Christmas time, all the shops get in these cheap Korean guitars or Japanese guitars or whatever it is, that, you know, because they'll sell them. You know, the parents are very gullible. Oh, Daddy, Johnny wants a guitar, we get him a guitar, and they pay quite a bit of money. You know, people pay £150 for a guitar and they think, oh, that's a lot of money, but it's not. This guitar I have here was €3,000 to buy. You know, so you progress from £3,000 to £3,000.
I'm a little bit the same about the bicycles. You see them on the wall there behind
yes.
you. So the bike on top cost multiple thousands and the bike on the bottom cost multiple hundreds.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one is better than the other,
yeah.
and it very definitely shows. Like, I
yeah.
couldn't have done the cycle that I did on the bike on the bottom,
yeah,
but I
yeah.
could absolutely do it on the bike on the top.
But guitars, you know, I started off as a rock and roll guitar player, but the first guitar my dad bought me was an electric guitar. And in my innocence, I thought you just plugged it into the wall and it worked, but of course it doesn't. You need an amplifier. So I got this, my bed was on a wooden floor in my bedroom. So I figured if I stuck the end of the guitar to the end of the bed, the whole floor would act as an amplifier, which it did. It resonated through the room. It made a big sound.
Yeah, I can
you
imagine.
Know. And that was how I learned my first guitar, and then, of course, got amplifiers. And Ballyshannon was a melting pot of music, really, because there was a Cayley band there called the Acero Cayley Band. And I used to see them. They had Acero Cayley Band on tour written on the side of the van. And I used to think, that must be fantastic. You know, I said, I want to do that. I want to go off on tour with the band. So, you know, there was music in. I was a member of the Musical Society in Ballyshannon. We did the Mikado and all the usual Musical Society things. And I really was obsessed with music. I remember that one of the first songs, I was only about six, and one of the first songs I would learn would have been this one. Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, the greenest state in the land of the free. Raised in the woods so he knew every tree. He killed him a bear when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, the king of the wild frontier. That was the first movie I went to. And I remember that song used to get played on the radio. And I just fell in love with Davy Crockett. Had to get the Davy Crockett suit for Christmas from Santa and all that. And the coonskin hat and the whole business. And that would have been one of the first songs I learned to sing. But the first song I ever sang in public was a one, you might know this one, it was a fella called Perry Combs, about 1958. And I don't remember ever sitting down to learn these songs. They were just on the radio so much that you heard them and you just kind of knew them. And I remember Dad told me to stand up in front of a microphone. He was setting up a PA system for the local gymkhana. And he said, stand up in front of that thing there and sing a song for us. I said, what do you mean? Just stand up there and sing. And what did I sing? Is it that one that you're always singing around the house? And it was this one. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Never let it fade away. Catch a falling star and put it in your pocket. Save it for a rainy day. Cause a love may come and tap you on the shoulder some starlit night. And just in case you feel you want to hold her, you will have a pocket full of starlight. And that, I mean, I remember being fascinated, just at this idea of a star falling out of the sky. You want to catch this star and put it in your pocket. Just simple melody and lyric. But I sang it and I heard my voice coming through this PA system all over the whole Gymkhana arena. And I thought, wow, that's great. I want to do that too. So that's what it was like.
music, obviously a huge part of your life the whole way through.
Yeah.
Ballyshannon, obviously very heavily associated with Rory Gallagher. Was there any...
Not a mention. Rory Gallagher was never mentioned in Ballyshannon, ever. And even when he was famous, nobody ever mentioned, because nobody ever knew that he was, that he had, his dad was working on the building of the power station, the Erin power station, Kathleen's Falls generating station for its full term. And his father was there, working there really only for about maybe 18 months altogether. And his mother and father were there, and that's how Rory happened to be born in Ballyshannon. But all through his career, even though I knew about, I mean, I knew an awful lot about Rory Gallagher from about 1967, 68, when he was with Taste and stuff like that. But nobody ever thought that he was born in Ballyshannon. It was only after he died, a local politician, what else, did you, figured, hey, wait a minute, he was born in this town, so we should really get involved. And they eventually they started a festival, and it's a hugely successful festival and a great festival. And now they have a statue. But I had the pleasure of playing at the launch of the statue, of the unveiling of the statue, which is a great thrill to be there that night.
Do you get up to Ballyshannon much?
We do. We still have a house there. My wife's family house is still there. We go down an awful lot during the drama season. We go down for the drama festival, which is my, it's one of my other obsessions is drama, amateur drama particularly. And when we were growing up, the drama festival was the highlight of the year. You know, real, all these very exotic people would turn up for about a week, putting on plays in the Abbey, and it's still in the Abbey, although a much better Abbey now than it was then. And I remember being fascinated by these people with makeup and all calling each other darling. It's lovely, and you know, they were all very arty-farty type people. And again, it was another sort of thing, yearning to be on the stage. You know, I wanted to do what they were doing, to be somebody else, get up there on the stage and be somebody else. And sometimes I think, even my own, sometimes I feel I'm really me when I'm on the stage. You know, I'm completely different off the stage than I am on the stage, you know, my head.
That was going to be my next question, actually. Is it you on stage, or is it a trying to be getting a persona?
It's the real me, because it's the one place I get to express myself properly. Get to say that the great thing about being a songwriter is that you can say things in songs that you would never say in real life. You can tell people that you love them. You can complain about things. You can give out about things. You can enjoy things. You can talk about sex. You can talk about anything in a song. But you wouldn't talk man to man or woman to man or man to woman just in a general conversation. You know, so you can express yourself up there. And writing the songs, you know, was a thing that came really only when I moved to Drumshambo, which was quite a long time after I first started music. So yeah, I'm the real me on stage a lot of the time.
How did you go from being the musician who liked to play bands here and there to actually becoming more into the kind of the business side of it, in terms of actually making a living?
I started off, you know, my first paying gigs would have been in Bundoran. It was the best training ground you could possibly have. This would have been now 1966. You had the Astoria Ballroom, all the top show bands. At that time, there were 500 show bands in this country all playing at the same time and all making a really good living out of it. But we got called, we had a little rock band, a drummer, guitar player, bass player, and a keyboard player. And we had various names. Soundstorms was one of them, I remember. But somebody heard that I played the guitar in Bundoran, this fella that had rented a pub for the summer. And he was suddenly, a busload of people from Belfast had arrived into the pub, and he had nothing to entertain them. And he rang me up and said, would you come out and play a few songs for these people out there? A few old ballads or something like that. So I remember getting my guitar and buying the Guinness Book of Irish Ballads in Paddy O'Neill's shop on the way out. And I put it down on the table, and I ended up playing 7 nights a week there for 3 months of the summer holidays. And I did that for 3 years in two different pubs, but we would play 4 hours a night. So you can imagine the amount of the experience you got from that. And you were up there, they weren't a sympathetic audience, they wanted to hear what they wanted to hear. You know, you would be expected to sing a Frank Sinatra song, followed by a Dubliner song, followed by a Clancy Brothers song, followed by a Beatles song. And a lot of the time in those days as well, it's changed now a lot. A lot of our night, 90% of the night would be people getting up out of the audience to sing. You know, you would have a thing called the noble call. I'd ask you, Breffni, would you go up and sing a song, and you'd get up and sing, and then you had the noble call. You could call whoever you felt next. So, you know, 90% of the night was other people. And these people would some of them could sing, some of them couldn't. Some of them could sing in tune, others couldn't. They would go through five or six different keys in the same song. So you had to learn all the chords. You had to make sure. And a lot of these songs were quite sophisticated, like I Left My Heart in San Francisco or whatever those, you know, Girl from Ipanema, all difficult songs. But if they didn't get it right, they blamed you.
Yeah, of
it
course.
Your fault. It wasn't their fault. You know, you couldn't back me. So you had to learn. So that was the best university, as far as I was concerned, for music. You know, that's where, and you know, then I moved to Dublin, got a job in the ASB, and I didn't play for another 6 years. But I went around watching other people because I'd been an electric guitar player, and I got very interested in acoustic guitar. And I began to watch people like Paul Brady and Donal Lunny and all kinds of people like that were around town in Dublin in 1968, 69. And I remember the first night I went to Dublin, I went to a place called Slattery's of Capel Street, and you had Liam O'Flynn on the pipes, you had Frank Hart singing, you had Al O'Donnell singing. These were all really well-known musicians at the time. Paul Brady was in the audience, you know, Donal Lunny was on. And the next day I rang Dad. I said, Dad, I need more money. I need to buy an acoustic guitar. And I bought a Yamaha FG-140 guitar in Danfe's Distributors in Angel Street. And that set me off on a completely new thing. So I literally sat at the foot of every stage in Dublin. And that time there were loads and loads of folk clubs, the Coffee Kitchen, the Universal Folk Club, O'Donoghue's, all kinds of places had live music. So you could sit in, as close as I am to you, and watch, well, how's he playing that? What's he doing there? You know, watch his right hand, watch his left hand. And I got extremely interested in acoustic, but didn't actually play anywhere. And moved back to Drumshambo then in 1973. And a fellow called Tony McGowan, they were organized, I came in November. The score competition was coming up, and Tony McGowan heard that I played the guitar, and he said, would you come into the score? And he wanted me to play football before he saw the size of me. He said, he must be a great footballer. I couldn't kick snow off a rope, but we get him into something. So myself and Eamon Daly and two girls, Peggy Barry, the late Peggy Barry, and Anne Malady, put a ballad group together for the score competition. I remember I went into the solo ballad, but I was disqualified because I didn't sing an Irish song. I sang a Scottish song. I remember that was that rules of the ring. But we got to the finals in Castlebar that year, the Connacht final. And I thought it was just, this was massive. I was on the stage singing. And we were, I have to say, we were different. We were doing things like Ewan McCall's Tunnel Tigers. We were doing different songs than would normally be, you know. We didn't just do the straight ballads. We had to be different. And I remember Only a River's Run Free was the big song at the time for Christy Moore and Flangsty. And I remember we sang that one. And but Eamon and myself then, the two girls weren't interested in taking it any further, but Eamon and myself formed a little duo called Jargon.
Yeah, I'm familiar with Jargon.
Yeah, and we bought amplification, £384. I remember we paid for the amplification. We borrowed the money. Noel Henry was the bank manager in Drumshambo at the time, and he was a big music fan. And he says, I'll give you the money. And he gave us the money. We paid it off in 3 months. We started doing the pubs. And I look at the diary back at those, 74, 75, 76, 77. We were playing in the summertime, 7 nights a week in pubs. And I went over to the Ballinamore Library where they have on microfilm all the Leitrim observers. I was just on a different mission, but I was looking at 1974, 75. And I was trying, that when I was there, I said, I must look for the first time we ever appeared in the paper. And I found it. But in those days, there were two full pages of the Leitrim Observer of ads, small ads for music and pubs. There was a massive amount of music. So there was loads of places to play. You know, you could play. And you know, God bless it was a great learning ground. Like more, you're always learning in this, Breffni. You know, you're always learning something. You're always, you know, you find out something. If you can survive in a pub, you'll survive anywhere. Because those days, you could be playing with a pool table in front of you and a television behind you and a dartboard over here, and you'd be expected to entertain people at the same time. You know, darts flying past.
And people not really there to hear you. Yeah, not really. To talk to each other.
Yeah, and we were quite handicapped because we, you know, I've never been someone that just does what's popular. I always have to be doing something different, you know, and we were always different, you know. But we enjoyed it. Eamon himself stayed together. We added Brendan Emmett then after that. And eventually Eamon had enough after a very long gig. We were playing in Letterkenny one night, 79, I think it was, very bad snow. And it took us 8 hours to get back in the snow. And Eamon said, I've had enough, because he was late for school. And his true vocation was a teacher in Carrigallen. And he'd never been late for school. And he was a full half day late. He said, no, it's not for me. And he quit. So we continued on, Brendan Emmett, myself, with Jargon. And we went on to win the Letterkenny Folk Festival, which had been won by Clanna the previous year and Pumpkinhead the year before that. And that got us our first record deal with Polygram Records, and they brought out a single. And the single, I'll sing it for you, the single was a lovely song about a place I'd never been to, a place called Ballyburn, County Cavan. When I was over in England at one stage, and this fellow from Cavan used to start crying into his paint, and Saturday night singing about this, where he goes, I once knew a lad of this country who cherished the place he came from, where it seemed like the sun shone on every tomorrow, and laughter was in everyone, and the smile that came over his sad face when thoughts of it came to his mind would brighten dark corners in this lonely city when we ever fell to repine. Said, I'm from Ballyburn, land of my childhood dreams, Ballyburn, calling me home, Ballyburn. One day I'll take you there, we're close as the shore and the sea, Ballyburn. And that was our first single. And I remember it came out and I couldn't believe it. It was on the radio 4 times a day in those days. You when you had a song out, you could be played four. If you were on the RTÉ playlist, you were going to get played 4 times a day, and went on for about 6 weeks. And that kind of catapulted us into the full regalia of being in show business on a full-time basis. And I remember very quickly we were doing TV, you know, we were... Every second week we're on something on television and stuff like that.
But at that time, it's not like now where there's a local radio station and you're only talking about 2 or 3 or 4 channels on TV and radio at the time. So that's a much bigger deal now. It was a much more captive audience than it is now with people.
Exactly. All over the place. So if you got played on the radio, if you got played on Radio Erin, you could almost guarantee there were going to be a million people listening to it, because that was the only channel people listened to. There was no 2FM at that time. It was just Radio Erin, one channel. And BBC Northern Ireland... where we got to know a fellow called Tony McCauley, and Tony was a producer in BBC Northern Ireland. He produced a programme called As I Roved Out. We used to call it As I Dozed Off, because it used to take us so long to make it. But he liked us, and we literally did that. We must have done it 10 times, 10 different years. We did our own shows on it. We had guests with people like Ralph McTell and Freddie White and Paul Brady, all kinds of different people. And it was, you know... And I look back at some of them now, they were dreadful. I was so self-conscious. And I look at myself on those old programmes and, you know, you learn an awful lot as you go along. You know, you don't be as self-conscious. And then RTÉ had there was loads of live music programmes then. There's no live music programmes on television on RTÉ. Very, very few.
No.
The Late Late, maybe you might get the Late Late, you know, but even then, that's not enough, you know. So it's a completely different scenario then. There was no such thing as YouTube and no such thing as iPods, and everything was on vinyl. People went out and bought the record. You know, there was no such thing as people recording records, you know, buying a CD and copying it and giving it to their friends or whatever like that. So it was a completely different environment. And an awful lot of luck depends. We were lucky to meet Tony McCauley, for example, and then people like Ian McGarry and RTÉ and different radio. Gabe Byrne was very good to us. And I always had this professional attitude from playing a Bundoran down the years, and always make sure that everything is that you're covering every angle when you arrive to do. I remember arriving to do the Gabe Byrne show, and this is on the radio, and we only were booked to do one song, but Gabe said, would you have another one? And luckily enough, I had a song, but the band didn't. They weren't prepared, they weren't ready. But I always knew you should always have something in your back pocket, you know. And it's one of these things, I think, now that I present my own radio program, I see a lot of people, young people coming in, and they're all very good. There's some great talent around now. But I think they need to be taken by the hand a lot of the time to learn about how to present themselves. You know, a lot of the time they'll turn up and the guitar isn't in tune. The guitar doesn't, the electrics don't work in the guitar. The lead, they haven't got a lead, they've forgotten something. There's a whole bunch of, I'm a very disciplined player. a performer in that I, you know, I almost have two of everything. I go to a gig with two guitars. You know, I'll always bring an extra, something extra that I, you know, that I, you know, two capos, two tuners, two of everything, two sets of strings in case I break strings and stuff. All that kind of stuff you learn by being on the road and, you know, doing it and doing it and doing it. But how do we get into this now? I kind of lost track of it. We've gone off on tangent as usual.
Tangents are fine on this show. Yeah. We like tangents on this show. I think we were chatting about just the way things are at the moment in terms of...
Yeah, well, if you've got, you know, if we can move very quick, swiftly on. You know, we went on and after being with Jargon, the band kind of drifted apart. And I got to know a lady called Maura O'Connell, who I went to. I had songs, I was writing songs then like that, nobody's business. You know, just writing. And I had songs that I felt would suit her. And she was on in the Bush Hotel one night, herself and a fellow called Mikey Hanrahan, who went on to be in Stockton's Wing. And Maura had been with the Donnan at this stage. And I brought my cassette player and my cassette of the song. And I sort of cornered her at the end of the gig.
No. I want to stop you for a second because you're going to actually get to the stage where you're about to start playing the song, because I have a story I want to tell you about the song you're going to introduce.
Yeah. Well, it may not be the song you were thinking of, but the song you're thinking of came out of that.
Okay.
But I you know, singers like Maura are very reluctant to be cornered, and you know, but eventually got her and I got her to listen to it, and she liked it. And she said, "Have you any more like that?" And I thought, "Yeah, loads," and stuff like that. And I didn't think about it afterwards. She eventually sang that particular song to me. For me at the Cavan Song Contest, and we did very well there at that. And then she formed a big band, went over to Nashville and made this big album with, you know all the top Nashville musicians on it. And she came back and she put a big band together to tour, but it didn't work. She was swamped completely. And her manager rang me one day and he said, "Would you be interested in working with Maura?" You know, and I said, "What contact?" "Just the two E, just like as if you were singing in the kitchen and stuff like that." And I said, "Yeah." So she came down and we practiced and rehearsed for about a week. We nearly killed each other. We're two very strong characters, a lot of confrontations. But we eventually ended up on the road. And we worked together for about 2 years. But during that time, Maura recorded three or four of my songs. And one of the ones that I had to trick her into recording, believe it or not, I was doing a demo of it myself up in the north, in a studio in the north. And I said, "Would you come in and maybe sing a line or two of this song, you know, and let's hear what it sounds like?" And she sang it. And immediately it clicked. It was a song called "Feet of a Dancer." That was probably the song you were thinking.
That was the song I was referring to. And the story I have, because "Feet of a Dancer" is one of my favourite songs. In fact, it's my party piece. Now I'm not going to play it now. But it is. It's my party piece. I play it every time I pick a guitar up in public. And for me, the story and why it's kind of relevant to me, and I don't think I've ever told you this. I know I've mentioned once or twice I like the song. But back in 1999, it was... about March, you made an appearance on the Late Late Show, and I was down in the local pub. I was just turned 18, and we were playing pool on a Friday night, as most people around here would. And the entire pub went quiet when you came on the TV. And the first time I can ever, and last time I can remember, the pub went quiet. The audio was put up on the sound, and everyone sat and watched you on the Late Late. And you were talking about, and we will talk a little bit about it later. I know you don't want to dwell on Shane, your son who passed away in 98. In Boston, but we were watching you on the TV show, The Late Late Show, which is obviously an Irish stable every Friday night, and you were talking about Shane and warning families and parents about
the dangers. To America,
The dangers, and that while it's a fantastic opportunity, you also need to be very careful with where you take on employment and stuff like that. And you sang the song, and that was the Friday night, and then Monday night, we watched it, we talked about it on the night, and we forgot about it. And Monday night came, and I was in the car, driving my dad's car into town, into Carrick-on-Shannon, to drop back a video to the video shop in the days when you did such things. And I had a crash. And I was very, very lucky to walk away. I walked away. I had one scratch on the back of my hand as a memory of it. But I damaged the car. I was very lucky. The whole driver's side of the car was damaged. And I was very, very lucky to walk out of it. And I came home. Didn't go to school the next day, and the repeat of the Late Late Show was on the television in the kitchen, and you came on and you sang the song, and for the first time I probably listened to the lyrics, and it really, really resonated with me that, you know, there was an incident where a couple of inches to the right hand side and maybe I mightn't have been there that day, and my family's lives would have been changed in the same way as your family's life was changed in 98. And the song has kind of stuck with me ever since. I was studying music at the time, and I went into my music teacher the next day. It was about 4 weeks to the Leaving Cert practicals. Yeah. And we'd been preparing our practical exams for 2 years. And I went in and says, I'm not doing that anymore. I want to do this song. I contacted you, and you very kindly came down.
I don't remember this.
With handwritten lyrics and chords for the piece. And I went into my teacher and says, I want to learn this. And at the time, the style of the song didn't suit anything I was able to play. But I dedicated myself for 4 weeks to actually go and learn that. And I ended up doing it for my...
And
that's the first song I ever played at an event that we did just before Music Practicals. So that, for me, is why the song is very relevant. And I'd love if you could play it for us.
Sure. And it's the Feet of a Dancer, obviously, the one you're talking about. But, you know... Yeah, it's been very good to me. It's been recorded hundreds of times by all kinds of people all over the place, including you now. So you're doing it as well. And you know, whatever you get out of it, that's what it's about, you know. I hope you find the feet of a dancer. I hope you can sing in the rain. I hope you find all the easy answers to your pain. It won't be easy. What can I say? There will be trouble on the way and around every corner. Terror and tears, but always remember that we're here. I hope you find the feet of a dancer. I hope you can sing in the rain. I hope you find all the easy answers to your pain. And I hope you find love and affection. I hope you find someone who'll care. I hope you find all the right directions everywhere. Everywhere. And it goes on and on and on.
It's absolutely beautiful piece of music. The lyrics are so important.
But funny, the song was originally written, and this only came out last year, because I never actually explained it. It was written about a girl called Anne Lovett, who sadly died in a grotto in Granard. She had been up to nearly to full term pregnancy, and was in this grotto. She had never told her parents, never told any of her friends that she was pregnant, and managed to conceal her pregnancy. And the first people knew about it was when she was found after having the baby in the grotto. Sadly, she died, and the baby died. And it was big news at the time. You know, I think it was 30 years last year, 30 years anniversary of her death last year. And I felt about the song. The song more or less says that, you know, you may go out into the world and things don't work out exactly for you. So always remember, as parents, we're here. You know, you can always come to us, no matter if you've shot somebody or you've robbed the bank or whatever it is. We'll always be here no matter what you do. And I related it, rather than look at a sad part of the song, I looked like, let's see what lesson has been learned from here that you should be able to... You should be able to tell your parents and friends, God, when you're pregnant, which is the most happy thing that could possibly happen to anybody. But sadly, at that time, it was seen as a stigma, and the poor girl died. So that's where the song came from, as a kind of a cheerful reaction to a sad event.
Your own family life, you have, you're married to Goretti,
yeah,
who I believe makes all the decisions in your house.
She does, yeah. We call her She Who Must Be Obeyed in our house. And she is. But she's, in fairness... You know, our marriage has survived beyond, you know, really shouldn't have survived, because I was away an awful lot of the time. And when I look back, sometimes I think I was very selfish, and she was very generous in that she indulged every fantasy I ever had in regards to music. And, you know, I mean, a lot of this thing of music, and a lot of it, it's very tenuous. It's not something you can put your finger on. What do you want from being a singer-songwriter? What do you want from it? I don't know what I want from it, but I just want to do it. And, you know, she stuck with me through thick and thin. And there were a lot of thin times, you know. I mean, there was, when you think, if I was playing 7 nights a week, Granny's sitting at home 7 nights a week, you know. But she didn't. She was very much involved in the community, and she went out with her friends and stuff like that. But at the same time, you know, you know, she had to put up with all, and she's very camera shy. I think her first time on television was last year when Mary Kennedy came down nationwide. And when Mary came down, she rang me before she came down. She asked me would I mind her coming to the house, and I said, well, I'll have to ask Reddy. And Reddy wasn't happy about it, because she didn't want, you know, it took a long time to persuade her to actually go in front of the camera. So that was the very first time Reddy appeared more or less deliberately on television. You know, I can't get her off it since. She wants to go on everywhere now.
Speaking of television, the Eurovision Song Contest is one of the biggest television shows across Europe and the entire Europe for the entire year.
Yeah.
How did that come about? I know there's kind of stuff out there about what Paul was supposed to do and it just wasn't working and you were...
No, what actually happened... For years I'd been putting songs in. You know, I was in the National Song Contest in 1985 and again in 1987 with songs I'd written myself. And I knew Brendan Graham for... The first time I met Brendan Graham was, believe it or not, in 1975 when he was when he won the Manor Hamilton Wild Rose Song Contest. He used to have a great song contest in Manor Hamilton at that time with a song called Sing Me an Old Irish Song. And I kept up the relationship with Brendan. We wrote songs together and we were friends for a lot of years. And so he'd come down and I'd go up to his house and stuff like that. But he came down to Drumshambo with this song called Rock and Roll Kids, and you know, he said, would I do a demo of it? And I was big into country music at the time. I was big into Don Williams and things like that. So I said, yeah, you know, and I did the demo was something I did. I remember 62. I was 16 and so were you, and we lived next door the avenue, and it goes, we were the rock and roll kids, rock and roll was all we did, and listening to those songs on the radio, like that kind of a version of it, and I knew it didn't work, you know, but that was what I was doing at the time. So about a year later he came back and he said, I got another fella down with that song, he said, a fella called Paul Harrington. I'd never heard of Paul really, but it turns out I had met him, but I certainly hadn't remembered meeting him. And he played me this, just Paul on the piano. And I said, Brendan, that's the version. That's the one, you know. And he says, what are you going to do with it? I said, I'm thinking of putting it into the Eurovision Song Contest. And I said, oh yeah, don't change anything. Just put it in like that. And he put it in, unknowns to me. I ended up on the judging panel that year. And the song comes in, and I said, I have to. You see, it was run on a very strict basis, though. They were in a firm accountants would watch what you were doing, all that. And I said, look, I have to abstain here. I know who wrote the song. I know the song. And it would be very unfair of me now to sort of vote for that particular song.
It's very honourable.
Yeah, well, that's the way it was. So the song didn't qualify that year. The following year, then he came along and he said, I'm thinking of putting that song in again, but I think it needs something else, you know. And I said, he said, would you put a bit of guitar on and maybe sing harmony with Paul? And I said, so I really want to go into Eurovision this year. I said, we were moving house, actually. The power station had closed down and we were moving to back to Donegal. And I said, no, I don't think so. And he said, well, think about it for a day and come back to me. Or I said, sure, what else? So I'll go for the crack. And met Paul in Lombard Studios, and it was going on. They used to have it on the Kenny Live program, the Saturday night on the television. Met Paul in the afternoon. We had one run through it, piano, and it just fell into place. It just fell into place, and that was it. We went on and we sang it. I remember at the rehearsal, the Minute Chamber Choir were on, and I was in awe. I love choirs, you know, and I was looking at this Minute Chamber Choir, and they were rehearsing over there, and then they finished the rehearsal, and they were still there when we started our rehearsal. And they applauded at the end of it. And they go, just the Minute Chamber Choir. Applauded us.
Was that the first time you realised this could actually be something?
No, I kind of knew that once myself and Paul sang it, I knew there was something special in there. It was one of those things that a combination of guitar, piano, two vocals working together, not contrived. Like when we sat down, it was as if you sat down there with a piano, I sat down there, and it literally was never even worked out. He played what he had now complimented it, and that was it. And we never ever played it the same way twice.
Really?
There was always a subtle difference in every, even on Eurovision, from the time we sang it in the competition, then to the reprise, and every time since, there's always, you know, we'll always wink at one another, oh yeah, there's the difference this time, you know, you've got a slightly different card there that time.
Is it an in-joke now at this stage?
Yeah, you know, and Paul will always, you know, I'll just throw in an extra little note somewhere, and he'll, yeah, you know, and that could be when we're on. We know we've done it, you know.
How well do you know that song now?
Too well sometimes. You know, it's not that you don't like singing it. I love the song because it's a great song. It's so simple, and you don't need any band. You can do it sitting here. You don't have, you know, most Eurovision songs have the full shebang, the orchestra. And funny enough, somebody told me when I was 14 that I had said, I'm gonna win that song. I'm gonna win the Eurovision Song Contest someday. Similarly, I said this, you know, and I always had this dream. If I did ever get to, you know, it'd be great going out with the orchestra, Noel Keelan conducting, and the tuxedo and the whole business. And the one year we get into it, the song didn't suit the orchestra. We said we didn't want the orchestra. We'd say we'll go for it this way. It'll stand out more. It was a clever move, you know.
I actually almost made money on you winning the Eurovision. And I'm not a betting man. I wouldn't go into the bookies at all. But I had a private bet of 100 to 1,
yeah.
And I put a euro on it with my uncle.
Yeah.
Who, and the bet was a 3-part bet.
Yeah.
And all three of them had to come in.
Yeah.
So I was going to the World Cup that summer as a 13-year-old, and the bet was that Ireland would reach the quarterfinals of the World Cup, that Leitrim would win the Connacht Championship, and that Ireland would win the Eurovision. Now, on the back of the fact that we'd won it, I think, in 92 and 93 already, my uncle decided this was the safest bet in the world.
Yeah,
Leitrim would win the All. Leitrim win the Connacht Championship. Hasn't happened in 67 years. It's never going to happen. It did. That Ireland would win the Eurovision. We'd won it so often, it was like, no, we can't keep winning it. We're not going to do
three in a row.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. So that's a safe enough bet. And he worked in RTE at the time, so he was well in on that. And then on top of that, Ireland will reach the quarterfinals of the World Cup. That was probably the safest bet.
Yeah.
The only one of the three not to come in.
Yeah.
Because we got knocked out in the second round. So, yeah, that was my earliest exposure to gambling. And probably my last proper bet in that respect. But, yeah, no, it's one of my favourites as well, Rock and Roll Kids. And obviously everyone remembers the night. Do you look back on it? Because obviously that's also the night that Riverdance was born.
Yeah, I remember it very, very much for the Riverdance element of it. Because we didn't really care whether we won or not, to be quite honest.
Really?
We didn't. There was no hunger. We just wanted to. It was, you've no idea, Breffni, to walk out into the Point Depot and represent your country. You know, it's the only thing I was ever going to be able to represent my country at if I ever was going to do it. Certainly not at sports or anything like that. And we just said to each other, we're going to enjoy this 3 minutes, you know, and we did. We just loved every second of the 3 minutes. It was just, you know. And we could, you know, we always had these little knowing glances and signals to one another, you know, yeah, this is great, isn't it? You know, kind of, here we are, 400 million people looking at us, and here, two gobshites picking up here singing a song, you know. And for that reason, winning it was kind of icing on the cake, you know. But we used to joke, you know, we used to do all these press conferences during the thing, and we'd say, of course, we're going to win this, you know, you understand that, you know, we're going to win, you know, like, and people, oh yeah, very cocky, and all that kind of stuff. I remember post-Eurovision, and we were over doing a television show in Germany, and there's like a UN interview, and a studio audience, and how is it that Ireland is now winning, you know, 3 times in a row, and how is this thing? Well, I said, you know, we have figured out the formula, and as a matter of fact, Paul and myself are running seminars now and we're going to tell people how to win the Eurovision Song Contest. Oh, and when are these seminars happening? Can you give us the dates? You know,
yeah, very serious. Yeah.
They don't get it, you know, they don't get the humor. But that was, I mean, so many funny things happened in that year. We had a great, great time. And again, when I look back at Goretti, would have been sitting at home a lot of the time. You know, we were in Europe nearly for the whole year. Because Europe, it's big in Europe. And we tend to think of ourselves. Remember, funny, I was doing a show with Johnny Logan there recently. And Johnny, I just said to him, do you ever get kind of annoyed that you never were as big a star in Ireland as you should have been? You know, that you should have been really big. He said, there's 4 million people in Ireland. There's 84 million people in Germany. I'm doing very well in Germany. So you can imagine 4 million. We're quite a small country. And we tend to think, you know, the whole world revolves around us, you know. But I've just finished an album that I did there just before Christmas over in Germany, and it's not even going to be released here.
Well, that's interesting, because I know Ronan Keating is one example of someone who doesn't even bother to promote albums in Ireland. He'll release it, but he won't do the chart show circuit or the radio circuit.
You see, the market is so small here, you know, unless... The only people that have managed to sustain a market in this country over the last, really, and have a continuous success in it, are the country bands. The Nathan Carters now, the New Breed coming up, the Derek Ryans. That has been the most successful local industry, local music industry, of all the area's successes. You know what I'm saying? Now, the U2s obviously didn't... the market here, 4 million people, they have the world. You know what I'm saying? So earlier this year, a German record company rang me up. They'd heard one of my songs on YouTube and they said, would you like to do an album with us? They're a company called Stockfish. They specialize in acoustic music. And they will sell millions of albums because they have a market. They have a worldwide market, not just in Germany, but in Scandinavia and America, Australia. And, you know, that album will never come out here.
In terms of percentage of your sales, without getting into hard figures, but what would you guess your sales percentage would be from Ireland of your overall sales?
Oh, very small. Very, very small. Because, you know, how can I put it? If you look at the market now, you know, if you look at the number of people, there are no CD shops anymore. Nobody buys CDs. The only people who buy CDs are the country and Irish people. They go along to the concerts and they buy marketing stuff after. They buy T-shirts and books and CDs of the artists. You know, when was the last time you bought a CD? You know, I buy them, if I'm going to buy them, I'll buy them online. You know,
I bought one on the street from an artist, from a band on Grafton Street.
Yeah.
Key West.
Yeah.
It's the last time.
That's
5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's probably, and in fact, I paid double what it costs on iTunes.
Yeah.
I paid them €15 iTunes is
$7.99. Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I know they're getting all of the €15.
And it's nice to have the CD.
Yeah, it is.
You know, but the overall market is gone for CDs, you know, except this company, that the Stockfish company that I'm with now, they specialize in hi-fi enthusiasts. They have cornered a market for people who really have high-end hi-fi. It's coming out on vinyl. And it's coming out on CD, but on very ID, they record and they master specifically for high-end vinyl, for high-end hi-fi systems. And they have cornered that market. And, you know, whereas their market for that alone, they would have 4 million people that would buy that alone. Never mind 4 million here in Ireland. You know, if you get even a corner of the market here, you're talking in the thousands rather than in the millions. You know.
How has life changed for you pre-94 and post-94?
Huge change. That was the biggest change of all. We were about to move from Drumshamble. We had bought a house in Ballyshannon because the power station had closed and we were going to move lock, stock and barrel. The kids were very unhappy about it. But because Eurovision came along, Grady said, well, if I go back to Ballyshannon, I won't know anybody down there. I'm going to be stuck in Ballyshannon and you're going to be off chasing around Europe. So we sold the house that we'd bought in Ballyshannon and decided to stay here. That was the big change. But on an overall basis, suddenly you're hurled from not so much. I mean, I'd worked a lot down the years before Eurovision with people like Eleanor and Maura O'Connell and Jargon and all the rest. We were quite well known and we worked a lot in Europe and we did a lot of, Eleanor Shannon and myself had toured all over Europe, you know, as just the two of us. And so, you know, but suddenly you become public property when you win the Eurovision. You're sort of, you know, you're sitting in a restaurant and somebody will be bringing their kids over to look at you and all that. Okay, you're suddenly a celebrity, if you know what I mean. People know you no matter where you go. People are, you know, and now what's happening is you'll sit there, you're having your dinner and somebody brings their kid over and the kid wouldn't have even been born when you were there. And they say, do you know who this is? And then, no. And then, the rock and roll kid? No. Never heard of it. No. And I'm meeting people regularly now. I mean, I had three beautiful artists on the program, on my radio program last Saturday, Tomás Skelly and Adam, can't think of his second name now, and a couple of girls. They were all average 15, 16 years of age, but they were wonderful, you know, but they weren't even born right then, but they knew who I was.
Well, everyone around here knows who you are. You're kind of one of the people who stands out when you think of anyone famous from Leitrim.
Yeah, but that's top of the pile. You know, the profile is always there. And it can be a bit of a handicap sometimes. You know, you can't really let your hair down and get mad drunk or something and fall out of a pub, you know.
You don't strike me as the type of person who would do that anyway, Joe.
I was. Yeah, you know, we all did drink when we were your age too. You know, it was just as serious an issue then as it is now. You know.
I want to talk about something that has been mentioned in a couple of other places, but talking about drink abuse and stuff. Mm. I know your brother struggled with
in a big way, drink and drugs, but we both came from the same family, but he, whatever genes he, you know, he was an obsessive. He thought he could knew the way around everything. He could never do things the straight way. He had to think of a shortcut for doing everything, and he literally ended up a heroin addict, an alcoholic, and he ended up on the street. And he would ring up in the middle of the night, you know, mad drunk, you know, and they'd say, where are you sleeping? It'd be in the middle of winter. He said, oh, there's a warm air vent at the back of Debenham's shop, where, you know, and I sleep over that, keep me warm. He'd been beaten up several times, he'd been burnt out, he'd been pissed on in the street and stuff like that, and, you know. And my dad, who was living here with us in Drumshambo at the time, and my dad couldn't figure it out. He couldn't. Can he not just give it up and stop? You know, he didn't get the addiction part of it. He just didn't get that people could be, you know, that they had to. He literally, and sadly, when he died, it went over. Obviously, we went over to for his funeral and all that kind of stuff. Eventually, we brought his ashes back here to Drumshambo. But the day they had the service in Swindon, all his street friends turned up. All the people who had been on the street with him, all kinds of strange people. A nun turned up who used to get up and had a little early morning cafe at 6 o'clock in the morning. Declan used to go in there. But obviously I brought them all to the pub afterwards and we were having a few jars and stuff like that. But the way they talked about his heroin thing was, I loved his drugs. Had to have his drugs. Love first thing in the morning, first priority, get his drugs. And he'd go into a supermarket, steal something and sell it and then, you know, get the money. And, you know, and Declan had sort of developed ingenious ways of, he had a dog and he used to sit in the street, you see, and he'd get people to go over and pet the dog. And he'd, would you like to get your photograph taken with the dog? You know, and they'd get the photograph taken with the dog and the dog would drop a few pounds into his hat and stuff like that, you know. But the only one that was going to cure Declan was Declan. And sadly, you know, my dad would be sending him money, and, you know, I'd say, Dad, you know, you're really only feeding his habit. You're only going to make it, that's not going to help him in any way. And, you know, you would only hope that he would reach rock bottom and then realize it and, you know, come to his senses, but he never did, sadly. He came to a very sad end, and that's the extreme end of drink, Breffni, you know, and we do have a, I think we have a problem with the drinking culture here. Everything we do has to revolve around drink. You know, if there's a meeting, it has to be in the pub. If you're going to meet somebody, it's in the pub. If you're going to go for your entertainment, it's in the pub. And, I mean, we all like a drink.
I've never had a drink.
You know, you don't drink?
I've never had a drink in my life.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm one of those rare breeds around here.
Yeah.
Just never been interested.
Yeah.
Never.
And what was it? What was your tipple? What was your, if you like, your drink?
Well, now it's water.
Yeah.
It's water or maybe...
No, but what I'm saying is, how did you relax?
Oh, for me, it was sport.
Yeah.
Sport and music to some extent.
Yeah.
And then growing up, I got involved in poker, which kept me... kind of, it was my social life. Rather than going to the pub, I would go and spend 20 euros or 30 euros on a poker game.
Yeah.
Which would be less than probably what I would have spent in the pub.
Yeah.
And it was a night's entertainment. You're sitting down with 8 or 10 lads around a table chatting.
Did you ever feel isolated then when you were out in the pub with your friends and they were all drinking?
No, I wouldn't have been a recluse like that. I'd still have gone to the pub.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But did you feel different?
They reached a certain part of the night where it was like, okay, now I'm done. I want to go home.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was younger, it was fine because I was usually the designated driver. So my friends were allowed to go out if I was driving.
Yeah,
because
their
mothers knew I'd always get them home. Because I'd be driving and I'd always be sober.
Yeah.
And then they would look after me for the night. So basically, if there was a charge in the door, they'd pull. So I'd bring 3-4 lads in the car. And they'd pay £2 or £3 each and get me in.
Yeah.
And then they'd buy me a drink each. And that was my night sorted. So my night outs were free. And it wasn't because of that, but that was just a kind of a bonus. So they paid less to cover me than they would have to pay a bus or a taxi to get them home and whatever. And they got dropped at the door. And so it was always kind of one of those... things that I just never really... I was never, no more than yourself, as you said at the top of the show, I was never number one of any list of a sports team I ever played for. I was always number 12 or 13 on the soccer team, or 15, 16, 17 on the gaming team.
Yeah.
So I found out at about 16, 17 that if I was sober and fresh on a Sunday or Saturday morning, and one of the lads didn't show up because he was hungover,
you were going to get a game.
I'd get a game.
Yeah.
And I wanted that more than I wanted
the drink. And why do you think you were 13, 14, 15 on the team?
I just wasn't. I wasn't focused enough on it. I wasn't prepared to give the sacrifice. Like I ate what I wanted. I didn't worry about the stuff that I look at my 14-year-old nephew now, and he's everything that goes into his mouth is
always analyzed.
He would pick up a bottle of something and read the nutritional information.
And what about the actual physical fitness and the running and the
I was just an average kid, but I wasn't. I wasn't aware of what is required to do that at the time. I loved it, but I just didn't have... I was... The best way to describe it is probably I was a jack of all trades, master of none.
Mm.
I could be... I'd be ahead of the guys who were no good.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't quite be the top guys on the team.
Mm.
But yeah, when I'd get my chance, I'd take it. Like, for me... This was supposed to be me interviewing you.
Yeah,
but,
I just turned the tables on you here.
But for me, at say 17, I wouldn't have played a soccer match... for 2 years training, and then at 17 one day 11 players show up, and I was a sub goalkeeper, and the guy in goals had been screaming for about a year, could he play up front?
So
the coach said, well, you'll be better outfield than Breffney is, so Breffney, you go in goals, you play up front. And he scored 2 goals, and we let one in. Nothing I could do about it, but we won the game 2-1. 3 weeks later I'm still in goals and he's been dropped. And that kind of stuff. And I played every game then for the next year or two until I kind of went to Dublin University. So for me, it just wasn't about the alcohol. It does annoy me, the fact that everything rotates through the pub.
I have a thing about it as well, and I like a drink, but I don't, not that very often. I don't drink that much. Never really did. I was never a big drinker, but we went out, and I think the drinking levels then were just as bad as they are now, except now they're drinking at home a lot of the time. Youngsters are sort of drinking before they go out, and there's no measures. If you get a bottle of vodka and you put it up and you pour it into a glass, you could be having triples and you wouldn't know what you were drinking, just firing it back. But at least when you go to the pub, if it's a half one you're having, it's a half one you're going to get and paying for it and stuff like that. But even then, I think we almost have too much now. I look at the increase in the rate of young people's suicides, and I think a lot of the time they commit suicide over a trivial thing, because they've come to the stage, I've got everything, I've got the fast car, I've got the 42-inch screen television, I've got everything you could possibly want, I've been to America, I've been to New Zealand, I've been to Australia. The girlfriend says, sorry, we're split up, bang. Something simple like that. They say, well, what have I to live for? I've done everything. And they commit suicide. And that's one of the things in society that worries me a lot, is the amount of suicide there is.
Well, we can...
Because that's another day. That's another day's conversation.
I could keep going for hours on that one.
Yeah.
From 94 on, you've now full-time in the music, and then obviously you have Shane's death in 98. We're not going to dwell on that because you've spoken about that at length in plenty of other places. But I suppose we have to talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, well, Shane was the opposite to you and the opposite to me, in that he was a highly successful sports person. Everything he turned his hand to, when he went to Mels, he was on the senior team, he was, he just had it. He inherited a lot of that from his father-in-law, my wife's father, Jack Gallagher, played for Donegal, he played for Ulster. And so football, was in him, in his genes somewhere along the way. But he was equally good at no matter what he took up. I remember they used to have there still is a tennis court in Drumchamble. And himself and Seamus Maguire used to organise a tennis competition, a tournament, and it would last for 2 weeks. But they knew they were going to be in the final. They were the only players.
I think I played in
it. You could have played in it.
I'm pretty sure I'd played in that back in the day,
And
I got annihilated in the first game.
Yeah, well, Shane and Seamus always ended up dividing the spoils, because everybody had to put a half crown in or something.
I think it was £5 or £2.
But they always won it. And the final would last almost for days. They would be playing for days out there, but he was determined. And I remember when his class, all his class, he decided to stay on a seventh class, in Paddy O'Keefe's seventh class at home. And he was so disappointed not to be going to Mel's with everybody else. But we felt seventh class would have been a bigger, and it was, as it turned out. But because Barry Maguire, who had played for Leitrim, was going to Mel's, Shane thought Mel's is going to be, has the place to be, you know. The only tragedy was he was a great piano player, and the music was on the same day as the sports on a Wednesday. And he had to either do one or the other. So he ended up going for the sports.
Music obviously was never going to win.
But he would play, he would still play. And I remember he got an injury at one time in his hands. And he played the piano, you know, a really good piano player. But when they x-rayed his hands, every single bone in his hands was broken. I remember his fingers, he looked kind of crooked, all right, you know, but when you saw it in the x-ray, you see that had been a ball coming down and breaking it. And it healed by itself, you know. But every single finger in his hands were broken, you know, and yet he still could play the piano. Play the piano. But, you know, when they didn't, when Leitrim didn't qualify that year, and Galway beat them in the Connacht Championship, and Martin Carney rang me, and Martin's an old school buddy of mine, he was from Ballyshannon as well. He said, look, would you like to go out and play in Boston? And there's no question, of course he would, you know. And unfortunately, he got a job with a company that didn't look after health and safety, and he was killed when a scaffolding collapsed himself and Roland Stewart, the fellow that he'd never met and knew until then, he didn't really even know him that well then, and the two of them were killed, unfortunately. But it was a huge thing at the time, and it still is, you know. It's still, you know, there are times when, you know, when your mind is open and you start thinking about it. So I tell people that I've kind of compartmentalized, that I have these series of little boxes in my head for different things, and I keep the lid closed. But sometimes it'll open. It opened up again there when the Berkeley tragedy happened in America. The whole thing came flooding back, you know, and it was quite, it took us by surprise. Gretty and myself took us by surprise. And what happened was they rang me up from the Joe Duffy show to see what I come on and talk about this Berkeley thing. And it was only, I said, sure, of course I can do it. I do radio, I can do it in my sleep. But it was only when we started talking about it that suddenly it all came back. And then, of course, everybody wanted a piece of me then, you know, with the that woman with the blonde hair, what do you call her?
Miriam.
We do her show, and then the papers are ringing up and stuff like that. I suppose people, when something like that happens, people are hankering to see if there anybody else that could understand, you know, what it felt like, you know, what it felt.
Well, I remember at the time, I would have been 17 years of age and would have known Shane from going to Leitrim Games. And I remember hearing the news, I was in the Gaeltacht, and I was sitting at the front of the bus on the way to school in the Gaeltacht with Joe Flynn Jr. from Parker Channel beside me. And the two of us were there, and all of a sudden we heard Leitrim on the radio. And even though it was in English, we reached forward and put the radio up.
Yeah.
And it was the news on the national radio about Shane's passing. And I think we were due to come home the morning of the funeral, the removal. There was a guard of honour the whole way through.
Yeah, I remember that,
the road was lined the whole way through Leitrim Village. I think pretty much the entire town was out. And we actually insisted on getting collected early to come home.
Yeah.
And we literally met the funeral cortege by probably minutes and stood as part of the guard of honour. And it was a hugely emotional moment for us. I can only imagine. I think anyone listening, unless they've experienced it themselves, can probably only imagine.
Yeah, it's you know, as I say, Breffni, it's a difficult thing to talk about. And you know, every time I end up talking about it, it takes me a couple of days to get over it. So I really, maybe we should leave it.
Yeah, I was actually going to suggest we'll pass on. The idea of this show is that it creates an opportunity for people who have been through these kind of experiences of forging ahead with chasing their dreams and making the life that they designed for themselves rather than one that happens by accident. What three pieces of advice would you give to somebody who maybe quite hasn't had the same chances in it?
Well, you know, people kept saying to me, you should don't give up. You know, that's the one thing, you know. Now, I may have not achieved everything I wanted to achieve. You know, in fact, I haven't. But to get your first record deal at age 65, you know, to do your first actual album in another country, and people pay you in advance and do all the paraphernalia at 65, I know I'm not finished. You know, and rather than repeat rather than repeat Rock and Roll Kids for you again. And maybe, you know, I'll get this song, you know, a lot of the time we go around this world and we're giving out about things and we're crying about things and we're unhappy and whatever at all. But I always look at it, and when I look at the migrants coming across the Mediterranean from Turkey and from Syria, obviously, and these are families just like us, people just like us, and they haven't given up. They've literally are putting their life on a limb, getting onto a life raft, and they see, you know, so the determination, the idea of never giving up is one thing there. The other thing I think is be realistic. You know, look at your life and think, you know, am I really as badly off as I think I am? You know, have I not got success? So a lot of people don't realize they have success. They maybe have a lovely, successful family life and they've brought up lovely children and they don't think about, because yeah, I have had a great life. You know, I sometimes you're successful and you don't realize it. You know, and a lot of the time we're so distracted with some silly goal that we put up ahead of us that we forget to enjoy the moment. And that's the second one I'd say would be to enjoy the moment. And the third piece I'd say, and it's difficult sometimes when you get to the next level of entertainment, to be honest. You know, a lot of the time, people in the entertainment business, I think, oh, sure, we're playing 7 days a week. Oh, sure, huge, just after getting a major deal. You're on Facebook, and you'll see a lot of my Facebook friends will have, you know, just setting up here at the Sydney Opera House. You know, and I say, you in the Sydney Opera House. Why am I not in the Sydney Opera House? But you're in your own Sydney Opera House. You know, I sit down, I get up every morning and I play this guitar every day. Or not this one, or another one, or whatever guitar it is. And you know, a lot of the time is living in the now, enjoy the moment, you know, because a lot of the, Liam O'Flynn told me one time, you know, he said an awful lot of people, instead of enjoying the journey, they think they have to enjoy the destination. So enjoy the journey. The journey is just as important as where you're going, as where you were going to arrive at. So that, those are, have I got three there? I must have four.
Yeah, there's three, but there's a lot of things around there. You want to play this tune?
Yeah, it's a song I wrote for this album. Remember it now, and it's yeah. I can walk from here to there, I can see the sun, I can feel the love you share, I can be someone, could be struggling in the dark. I could have unseen eyes. My world could be cold and stark. I never realized how lucky I am to understand the joys of life. I've never seen trouble or strife. How lucky I am. How lucky I am. My days have been like fairy tales. Wherever I've set my sail, I found a haven. Most days I whinge and whine about a little I own, about the things that should be mine. I weep and moan, I worry over silly stuff. I'm never satisfied, I never seem to have enough. But I gotta confide how lucky I am to understand the joys of life. I've never known trouble or strife. How lucky I am. How lucky I am. My days have been like fairy tales. Wherever I've set my sails, I found a haven. Lucky to have food on my table, so many things that I am able to do.
It's absolutely beautiful. I love that. I love the lyrics in your songs. They're absolutely fantastic.
They're very important, you know, in my song. And, you know, one thing, I watch things like The Voice, you know, on particularly the Irish Voice. And a lot of the songs, people don't, whether it's the sound or whether it's the singers, you can't hear the words. And to me, a song is like a story. You have to tell it. You've got 3 minutes to tell a story, you know, in a song. So everything has to be, I mean, it has to be crystal clear, you know. The feet of a dancer, you mean you immediately hear, I wish I had the feet of a dancer, you know. I wish I could sing in the rain, you know. And all of the great songs tell the story very quick. Now, it could be a story, you know, I woke up this morning, the blues were on my mind. Yes, I woke up this morning, you'd left me far behind, or whatever it be, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so, but the blues songs particularly, you know, they tell the story straight out. You know, you hear it, you know, I'm sad, she left me. I'm happy, she's been, we had a great night last night, you know, whatever it is.
A big part of your life now is Shannonside Radio.
Yeah.
And the Saturday Connection on Saturday mornings. Mm.
That came about totally by accident, Breffni, and that Joe Finnegan, who was the main, sort of the anchor man in Shannonside, was off for a few weeks. And they were bringing in different people to present programs, you know, and somebody got the idea that I could do it. And I'd never had any hankering really to do radio or stuff like that. But I went in and I stuck on the headphones and I started to talk and I realized I have the world at my fingertips here. I have 45,000 people listening to me, you know, and I'm able to say things about people that I enjoy or people that I'd put on a record and tell people why I like that record, what's it particularly good. And they then offered me to do the Saturday Connection program, which is, I had done a program for RTE on Friday nights called the Friday Connection. So I decided to call this the Saturday Connection. And I said, I'll do it if you allow me free rein, that I can play the music that I like, have the guests that I like, and that I don't have to play to a playlist. I don't have to play music that I don't enjoy. And that was 9 years ago now. And I've had just fantastic different guests, different people who just want to talk, to people who want to, like yourself, people who want to play their new songs, people who have new plays out, people like Seamus O'Rourke, who's somebody I admire beyond. I think he's one of the most talented people in the country. He's just one of these new kids on the block. Mind you, he's nearly 50, but he's still one of the new kid on the block as far as the world is concerned. But all these different guests, I've had people like Steve Earle, I've had Guy Clark, I've had Bela Fleck, Jerry Douglas, all heroes on the record, because I know a lot of these people. So if they're in anywhere near at all, I just have to give them a call. Do you want to come down and let the Shannonside Northern Sound listeners know what you do? And it's been lovely that way, you know, in that, you know, I've always had, very rarely had a guest that didn't perform or wasn't interesting for people in some way, you know.
In terms of you personally, I know it's just maybe a month past your 65th birthday. Mm. Most people at that point are pipe, slippers, yeah. Feet up. What's the future hold for Charlie McGettigan?
Well, you know, I continue to... The only difference I made since I became 65 is I will now only do things that I like. There was a lot of time, you know, when you're bringing the children up and they had to go to university and you were taking events and gigs anywhere, you know, because you needed the money and you had to get pay the bills and all that kind of crap. But now I'm reasonably comfortable. Off, I have a decent pentage. I have the radio program on the board of IMRO and the board of the Dock, different things. And I'm now going to live in the now. I no longer have that thing up at the end that I'm aiming at. I'm just now doing things that I like. For example, that song, I needed songs for the album. And I'm writing like hell now, writing great songs and having great fun. And a lovely new one coming out now by Don Baker has just recorded a new song of mine as well. And a lot of people are looking for songs, and so, you know, and the gigs, I only just do, like I was in Riverstown, the pinnacle of success, I'm in Riverstown. But I arrived down in the community centre. They have a little small place called the Morrison House, named after James Morrison, the great traditional fiddle player. And the whole community was there. Equally so, the new little community centre that you have up there beside the church. I remember coming down to do a gig down there with Eleanor and Mickey Blake, and, you know, and just to be part of that community. Everybody there was there because they wanted to be there. Same in Riverstown the other night. And I just love that. I love amateur drama. I love, you know, being going to festival. Now, coming up to festival time, we'll go to maybe 15, 20 plays over the next and talking about them on the radio then afterwards. Maybe having some of the writers in or the directors and, you know. So I'm in a very good place now. You know, I'm just doing things I really enjoy. And thankfully, hopefully, it'll stay like that.
The final question on the show every week is, what can the listeners of this podcast do for Charlie McGettigan?
What can they do for me?
Yeah, if you had one favour to ask.
Yeah, keep listening.
Love it. Charlie McGettigan, an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
I loved it. It was great fun.
Thank you very much for coming down, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Thanks, Bethany.